Let's decide on the date.
My father came to England in the early 1880s. It was the time of the great wave of pogroms in Russia, and he thought it was time to get out. What stimulated him a little further was that he was approaching the age when he had been conscripted for the Russian army, which was of 18. So he thought, well, it's time to go. He lived in a sizable town by Russian peasant standards called Grodno.
Mm-hmm.
He came to this country. He had no particular trade, being 18 years of age. All he'd done was fishing, Riga, Baltic. Well, that's no trade in the East End of London.
What would he have done if he'd have stayed in the Baltic, or in Russia?
He would probably have settled permanently in Riga, which was
right.
A big town, and had the great advantage, as far as he was concerned, of what is called intellectual stimulus. There were newspapers, there were books, and there were people who incessantly argued about insoluble problems,
mm-hmm.
and that's what he loved. They came to London, went straight to the East End. There's a great many immigrants from Lithuania and Poland and Latvia did. And there, I don't know how, what way, he met my mother.
Right. Did he have any other relatives in the East End? I mean, did he go to anyone? Or did,
no, he went to a brother who had immigrated just slightly earlier, about a year earlier, who had settled in the West End. What is often overlooked, I think, is that the Jewish immigration is always considered as being an immigration to the East End of London.
Mm.
Well, in a very large extent it was, but there was an equally important settlement in Soho, particularly for garment trade, for peddlers, for people who sold things from stalls and barrows and so on. And his brother had settled there.
So we already had some family here, in fact, when he was...
Yes, but I don't think they'd seen much of each other, and I don't think they continued to see much of each other. They knew each other, and around, and so on, they saw each other. He just went to the East End of London for one very good reason. He'd already heard that the real radical movement in this country was among the Jews of the East End. And that was true. And one of the great German anarchists, Rudolf Rocker, who didn't know a word of Yiddish when he came to England, in fact, went to special efforts to learn Yiddish because he was told that the only audience for an anarchist would be among the East End Jews. They're crazy, you see. So that was one reason for going to the East End. Also, there was a Jewish theatre there which rather interested him. And he took various jobs, making cigarettes, making walking sticks, anything that turned up. The one thing he didn't do was tailoring. Never knew anything about that. It was always little jobs that you could take on for a few days and then drop, or do in your own time, or do as a self-employed person, which was terribly important to him.
Would he have had that opportunity had he not come to England?
I don't imagine so. He'd have been an employee of some kind, or he'd have got stuck, if he'd stayed in his birthplace, he'd have been stuck in a Jewish community which was absolutely ringed round, you know, as a ghetto.
Right.
but he regarded himself, for what it's worth, as a philosophical anarchist. The essence of philosophical anarchism is that you consider it degrading to to be in a relationship where you are the servant of someone else, but it is, if anything, even more degrading to be an employer of anyone else. So you have to work for yourself, that's all. And John's like making walking sticks for special customers, or making a few hundred cigarettes. You were your own master, you were your own workman.
Right.
So that's what attracted him to the East End. There were lots of little jobs like that.
Why do you think he became an anarchist? I mean, what motivated that?
I think partly this was his urban contacts in Russia. Grodno, by our standards, is a small town, but by the standards of Jews who lived in tiny villages in the settlement, it was a metropolitan town. And to go to Riga was like going to New York today. It was a great Baltic center with a very long history in the Baltic as a center. And that's where I think he picked up his interest there. And he was greatly fed by the activity of radical Jews of the East End. He used to, later on, drag me walking miles and miles, because he could never afford fare money, to meetings of the Workers' Circle in Cable Street to listen to them. I had a great victory when later on I made him compromise and let me go and hear some of the Clydeside rebels who were orthodox members of the Independent Labour Party.
Shocking.
That's right, he thought he was really giving way on that. He would stand behind me and say, a philosoph, a philosoph. And the contempt in his voice must have reached even the man on the soapbox. Anyway, that's where he settled to begin with. And then the problem, once he got married, was how do you make a living of some kind without disgracing yourself and making enough not only to buy herrings and potatoes for yourself, but also for a wife and for a growing number of children.
Where did your mother come from exactly?
She came from Lithuania.
Right.
And it's a small village outside Vilna, which was then Russian, not Polish as it is today. So he began looking around for things to do that would be more stable. And what he picked on to begin with was being a peddler. He was able to hire a pony and trap and get credit to buy various bits of haberdashery, and then he would load up and go off to the little villages of Hertfordshire. Particularly Hertfordshire was his favourite place. And
what time was this?
Well, I can tell you, because he was already established in that line of work when I was about 6 or 7. And it was before World War I.
Right.
And I was always taken on these outings. It was wonderful. We would go off in the pony and trap, and we'd just meander on and on. And we'd come to a pub and say, this is a place, get down, go in. And I remember on one occasion he left me in the trap, forgetting that the pony wanted to eat as well. And the pony began eating grass that rose steeply up a bank. And as the pony got higher and higher up the bank, I got lower and lower until I thought I was going to be well below the pony. I began screaming. And came out, pulled the pony back and took me into the pub with him, which he did regularly after that. And when that seemed reasonably adequate, you know, he felt he ought to lead a more stable life, so we moved to Edmonton. And at Edmonton, he used the front room, which had ordinary windows like any other little house, as a place of display for his goods and wares. And occasionally got a customer, but not very often. So from there he branched out and took a stall in the Edmonton Green Market, where things began to look up. Yeah. And from that...
Well, what was your mother doing at this time? Was she working?
She was looking after six children,
right,
plus another two that came later. And she was doing odd jobs like cutting down clothes and making them fit the younger children. And she also did the writing for my father, because she could write in Yiddish.
Yeah.
And she could read Yiddish. And he'd never bothered about either of
these. He just spoke it.
He spoke it, and he read, printed Yiddish.
Mm.
That was fine. There was always two or three Yiddish newspapers around the place. But written Yiddish, never thought it was worth his while.
Where did his, I mean, I remember you telling me about his political activity.
Yeah.
And where did they really take off?
Well, they took off while he was still in the East End and his first years in Edmonton in North London. Incidentally, this is related to his political activities. In the house in Edmonton, we had four pictures on the wall. One was a portrait of Emil Zola, of course, because of the Dreyfus affair. One was a portrait which I've never seen anywhere else. I've never seen the Zola one anywhere else. Was a portrait of Kropotkin.
Why that?
Why that? Because he was the father of philosophical anarchism. And then there were two pictures, reproductions, one of the worker's daughter and one of the squire's daughter. The squire's daughter was haughty, aloof, arrogant looking, dressed in fine clothes, but looking as sour milk. The worker's daughter was chubby, rosy cheeks, beaming away and hugging a loaf to her chest. And the contrast and the lesson and the moral was obvious.
Right.
If you want to be happy, don't have anything to do with these rich so-and-sos.
Yes.
Stay away from them.
That was a message on the wall all the time.
All the time, yes.
Yeah.
And he never parted with them.
Where are they now? You've still got them.
I think what happened to them was they went not to my eldest sister, who left home at the age of 14. She found life was a little too intense. She emigrated to America to go and live with my uncle. But the next daughter, Bessie, I think she got them when she got married. When she came out of the synagogue, she was told it was a present. It was hoped that this would poison her husband's mind and stop him being a paid labourer. He was a tailor with a regular job. Well, he then got another stall in Hartford and ran the two together.
Right.
But always, no paid help.
But you were helping on these?
I would help on the Edmonton one mainly, but occasionally he would take me out to the Hartford one as well, and I would help there. For some reason or other, the other children didn't. They were busy, you know, the age of 13 left school and you had to go to work, bring in some money. So as long as I wasn't 13, and then when I was 13, I got trapped into this educational ladder. So I was always available. You could always fit in education sometime.
That's right.
Um, And then from that point, he decided, okay, he could now, with the assistance of my mother and me and my younger sister, Hilda, he could operate a proper shop.
Mm.
So he opened a shop in Edmonton, in the Green. The Green's the marketplace, central marketplace for Edmonton. And it sold clothes and stockings, you know, usual sort of glorified haberdashery clotheswear shop, which did reasonably well until the war broke out. And then there was a great outburst of, which, understandable, I suppose, of anti-Germanism.
Mm.
Everyone who couldn't speak Cockney was considered a German in Edmonton. And, of course, Jews couldn't speak like Cockneys.
Right.
So it began to get very, very hot for Jewish people who couldn't speak English properly. They were accused of being German.
Can I just ask, what was the house that you lived in like? Do you remember that?
Yeah, very clearly. The front parlour, the front window was full of things he wanted to sell. Not full, only room for two or three things. Then there was one room, the parlour, which had aspidistra in. My mother always insisted there should be a large aspidistra, a couple of armchairs, and a sofa, and a little table.
Mm.
No one ever went in there. Then there was an intermediary room, which was meant to be a dining room, but in fact it housed a table. My mother was determined that we should all be great musicians.
Right.
She didn't know what she was up against. It was dreadful. And where we ate was in the next room, the kitchen.
Mm.
That was really the centre of the house, which had an open grate and there was always food going on it. Of course, with eight children, you can't sit them all down together.
No.
And also you can't count on them all turning up at the same time. So there was permanent supply of fried things, fried fish or latkes, or candied orange peel, anything that would make room for itself on the open fire. And then there was the scullery. The scullery had a copper, large open copper, where you did boiling of your clothes when you wanted to clean them. You had to light a little fire underneath it. When the fire was going, the water was getting warm, you pushed in all the clothes with a stick, added some soap, and let it boil for a bit. Stirred it from time to time, you took it out, and then came the tough job of putting it through the manhole.
Right.
God. You ever tried working a manhole?
You didn't enjoy it.
You could tear your guts out turning the handle on some of those clothes. No, it was all right. It was, you know, fun. After a while, you'd see who'd win. Would you win or would the manhole win? Usually I won.
Sounds like a really big house.
No, they were all very small rooms.
Oh.
And then there was a
long in a terrace or
yeah. It was one, a part of a terrace, yes. And then there was a reasonably long garden.
Mm.
and we had a civilized neighbor, the Mattocks. And they suggested that we'd both benefit if the fence between their house and our house was pulled down.
Mm.
We'd then have the illusion that we each had a large garden. And strangely enough, it worked.
Mm.
This stuff by the American poet, you know, that good fences make good neighbors, turned out to be absolutely wrong.
Mm.
Pulling down the fences really helped in that case. And that was right. Then, in our part of the garden, we kept chickens.
Right.
So we had eggs regularly. And once or twice a year, we would have our own chicken to eat as well. You know, and we would all go out and feed the chickens with maize and oats and on. Well, to cope with the conviction that all Jews were Germans, my father took into partnership a man who had a son in the army. So he stuck in the window of his shop a photograph of this son in his army uniform, showing that at least, you know, we were on the right side.
Right.
And then by a sheer fluke, this cousin of mine, he would be, the son of my father's relation in the West End, joined the army, became an expert on how to operate a machine gun, and had his photograph taken operating his machine gun, or ready to operate his machine gun. This also was put in the window. This was Lou, our cousin, the machine gunner from Soho. Well, you know, so
to displacate the neighbourhood.
Yeah. Oh yes, we were regarded as okay.
Right.
Then after the war, you see, this was by 1918, when I was already 12.
Right.
I, up till then in Edmonton, I'd gone to Montague Road Elementary School, which was about, I suppose, 2.5 miles away, which one walked at 8 in the morning, then walked back again at 12, and then walked back again at 1:30,
right,
and then walked back again at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was absolute hell, because among other things, it passed what I thought was the biggest Jewish cemetery in England, the Montague Road Cemetery. And one thought, my God, you know, how quickly can I get past the cemetery? But and it was a very tough school.
Mm.
I remember my first week there. There was always, among the regular students, there were always 20 or 30 gypsies, because there was lots of open space there, and they used to park near the school. And the biggest of the gypsies picked on me in the first couple of days to fight me. Well, my fighting tactics were very simple. As soon as I saw him approaching, I backed, and I kept on backing round and round the field until he got tired
and gave up.
Yeah. So I said to him, and my brother was watching this, my older brother, and he said, "Ah, that's not the way you fight. When you see him approaching to you and is within couple of feet of you, push out your right arm as hard as you can, and it'll hit him somewhere. And then while he's still bewildered that you're actually hitting him, hit him again, doing the same thing with the other arm, straight out." "Oh, fine." "I said, should we practice it?" He said, no, we don't need practice. No one here to practice on here except me. You remember it and do it, because he'll pick on you again tomorrow. He's already been telling his pals what he's going to do to you tomorrow."
You must have been terrified.
Yeah, I was. But the tactic worked. He tried 3 or 4 times, coming straight at me. I pushed out my arm. He gave up after 3 or 4, went away. And they left me alone after that.
Yeah. School toughie, were you?
I wasn't a school toughie, but at least I wasn't kicked around or anything.
And what did they teach you? I mean, what did you speak Yiddish at the time, or did you speak?
No, we spoke at home.
Mm.
We spoke a mixture of Yiddish and English.
Mm.
In that my parents spoke Yiddish, but the children spoke English.
Right.
And although we could speak, the children could speak a little Yiddish, and my parents could speak a little English, neither of us would give way.
Right.
We stuck to languages, but it's all right, we understood perfectly. It went on. And on the sort of great holy days, you know, like the New Year and the Day of Atonement and things like that, my mother would insist that I walk to Tottenham, which was the next borough, and go to the synagogue there. And my father would ostentatiously, when he should be fasting, should have been fasting, would ostentatiously eat his way through a rilo to show what he thought of religion. But he never did anything positive, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just a sort of negative to show that this right. this was not really what he approved of.
Right.
But in fact, there was one rule in the Abrams family that was never broken by either of them, that you must never under any circumstances hit one of the children.
Mm.
If the worst came to the worst, then the only way you could get relief from frustration or anger was to bang your head against the wall. They would do it.
Mm.
I'd seen both of them do it, rather than strike one of the children.
Mm. That must have, was that unusual at the time? I mean, was it?
Oh, it's very unusual.
Mm.
You could hear the yells
right.
coming from
right.
every house in the street.
Mm.
Every minute of the day, practically. And when the husbands weren't beating their children, they were beating their wives.
Yeah.
that was... I'd never known. What I do remember of my mother is something very striking that stayed with me all my life. I don't see why I should be embarrassed. I'll tell you. The child after me was my sister, Hilda.
Mm.
And when she was still quite young, my mother was breastfeeding her. And I came into the room, and I saw this strange animal being breastfed. I knew it was my sister, all right.
Yeah.
And my mother looked up and saw me looking sort of half puzzled, half, And what she did was simply to pull her breast out of Hilda's mouth and squirt my face with it, with the milk, warm milk, all over my face. And then we looked at each other and both burst out laughing.
Yeah.
And that... I will always remember, you know, this warm milk, and then the minute, no, quarter of a minute of absolute silence, and then we both burst out laughing. And you know, that was typical of her.
Mm.
And if she wanted to show me what an awful swine I was, she would go and beat her head on the wall rather than mine.
Sounds quite a strong woman.
Yeah, she was. She was small. She was pretty, but she knew what one should do and what one shouldn't do.
Mm.
One of her favourite sayings, and of my father's as well, but more hers, was, and I think it's the same in German, "Es passt nicht."
Mm.
It is not becoming for a Jewish person to do a thing like that.
Mm.
"Es passt nicht," and. We knew that when she said that, it meant, please, don't do that. And that was as far as she ever went in a rebuke. What was much more common with her, she would say, "Where are you going now?" And say, "Well, I'm going to walk down the street, see what's on at the movie, not the movies, the picture palace." And she would say, "Are you going to walk all that way? Put an apple in your pocket. And here, I've got some warm latkes I've just fried. Put one of those in your pocket, you'll be hungry." And I'd have to wrestle with her almost to prevent her putting food in my pocket. That was her contribution to my upbringing. My father's contribution, you know, was to inculcate me with his idea of sell political society.
But you were quite, I mean, this is, so we got to just after the war, did you,
yeah.
were you very conscious of the war, or was it just kind of...
Yeah, I was conscious of the war because the Zeppelins were dropping bombs near us in Wormley, in Hertfordshire. We could see them going over. There was a terrible blackout. There was no food. The reason we had chickens and then began to grow potatoes, because there was no sort of rationing.
Right.
You waited for someone to say, do you know they've got potatoes at so-and-so? And then the whole street would make a rush. You know, if you were very lucky, you could get some things called artichokes.
Mm.
Got it. And we never knew how to cook artichokes. But we always took what we could.
Yeah.
But that was one reason for our attempt at self-sufficiency.
Mm.
Well, then from Edmonton, there was a